Hey everyone, it's Dawn. So I'm really excited by the interview that I've got this week because I think that it's going to be something new and challenging for a lot of you. The guest that we've got this week is someone that I really admire and that I adore. I think that his way of looking at the world and his way of examining the current discussions that we have specifically around sexual freedom and consent are incredibly powerful, and they're also really scary in a lot of ways and very challenging. And so before we go into my interview with this person, I want to invite you to sit in any of the discomfort that may come up when you hear us talking about some of the topics that are on this week's episode. There are a couple of things that he says that he's taken a lot of flack for in the past. They are very controversial. And I even told him going into the conversation, and during the conversation, you'll hear me saying that, like, I have little red flags going up and I'm feeling uncomfortable because it's just so visionary and so so different. And he gives some really wonderful explanations. And I also think that one of the things that is just a failure on my part is I invited him on at the very last minute, and so we only had 50 minutes to do this really, really deep discussion, and there were so many other questions that I wanted to explore with him, because I've heard him talk about so many of these things at conferences. I attended this really beautiful talk that he gave on the ways that consent is failing us at Catalyst Con a year and a half ago, and I talked to him as part of the Explore More Summit over the winter. And so I'm very familiar with a lot of his philosophy and the way that he's unpacking some of these really huge, like, cultural global conversations. And I'm hopefully going to have him back on the show in the next couple of months so that we can kind of pick up the conversation where we left off. But as I was editing the episode, I just kept thinking some of the things that get said in this episode could potentially really upset some of you. And so I just want to invite you to listen to the entire conversation. And then if you feel discomfort coming up or resistance coming up, to really dig into why you're feeling those things. There are a lot of people out in the world who, when they say things, I get just, like, immediately pissed off. Like, men's rights activists, for the most part, when they say things, their perspective is just so nuclear to their own experiences that they often can't even begin to understand that there are differing experiences out in the world. And so I get so just, like, worked up and angry and tight and defensive with people, you know, like super religious folks who just can't allow space in their consciousness for the fact that other people might be experiencing the divine and faith and the world differently from themselves. This particular guest is very different, and this is one of the reasons why I really adore the fact that he makes me so uncomfortable. He's very aware that his experiences and his perspectives are his own, and that people of different genders and people in different bodies and people from different parts of the world have very different perspectives. And he's very, like, open and upfront about the fact that he can really only speak for himself. And so I just invite you to listen to this really deep, philosophical, like, heady chat around feminism and sex work and consent with an open mind and an open heart. And I would love to hear from you on what you think about everything that we discuss, but definitely invite yourself to feel uncomfortable with some of what you're going to hear, and then roll around and maybe why you feel uncomfortable with it. I really loved having this discussion with him, and I can't wait to have another one. And I look forward to hearing what you think about it. I also just wanted to give you a heads up that Dylan and I are going to be in the studio 2 days from now. So I'm recording this on Sunday, August 14th. And in 2 days, Dylan and I are going to be in the studio together for an episode to get caught up with Dylan and to field some of your questions together, just like the good old days. And I'm also doing interviews this week with Emily Nagoski, who wrote Come As You Are, which all of you know is a book I talk about constantly. And I'm really excited about that chat. I'm also talking to Karen BK Chan, which promises to be such a gentle and beautiful chat around like emotional intelligence and feelings and communication. She's one of my favorite humans on the planet. So there are some really incredible talks coming up over the next couple of weeks, and I can't wait for you to hear them all. Don't forget to go to sexgetsreal.com and take the location poll so that you can help me decide where to go with the Sex Gets Real tour. And let's jump in to this week's interview with the one, the only, Connor Habib. There's also two little quick notes that I want to make about this episode. The first is, at some point later in the episode, you'll hear Connor use the term SWERF. And for those of you that don't know, a SWERF stands for Sex Worker Exclusionary Radical Feminist, or feminism. So when you hear him talk about SWERFs, those are people who label themselves as like vehemently anti-sex work. So sex worker exclusionary radical feminists. So people who are involved in feminism but don't think that sex work can have any part in that. And the other thing is you're going to hear some little like high-pitched tweeps, a couple of points in the episode, and I believe that that's Connor's bird in the background, which I think is super adorable. But just in case you're wondering what the little noise is, we have a little friend in the background. So enjoy the rest of the episode. Hey everyone, it's Dawn Sarah with Sex Gets Real. I'm really excited about this week's guest. I interviewed him as part of the Explore More Summit, and it was one of my very favorite of the 30 interviews that I did. It was such a rich discussion. So, Connor Habib, I want to welcome you to the show.
Hello.
Hi. So for those of you that don't know Connor, he is an author, a lecturer, a porn performer, and a sex workers' rights advocate. He's also the vice president of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee and a member of PEN America. And one of the things I loved on your About page, Connor, is that at the very end, it said that you're the only person who has ever won awards for writing, teaching, and porn, which is really cool.
That I know of. There might be someone else out there. I just found out about this French porn actress who wrote novels and directed a film. So I'm just like, you know, it's like, I just said that and just made that claim. But I think maybe in the U.S., let's just say that.
Well, I have to say, I think one of the things that really stands out about you is your writing and your lectures and your interest in like philosophy and anthropology. And, I mean, you seem to know a lot about so many things. And I have to just admit that whenever I listen to you speak and when I talk to you is for the summit, I was just so intimidated by how like eloquent and thoughtful you are about all of these things that you talk about. And I think one of the things that makes such an impression on me, I was just saying this to my partner today, is that like, I feel like so many of us are trying to kind of push at the edges of the existing framework that we're in to like move people just a little bit outside the paradigm that we're in. And you like already have this vision for like beyond the paradigm that we're in. And sometimes the stuff that you write about actually like makes me a little uncomfortable because I'm like, God, that's so forward thinking. I can't even imagine what that would be like.
Well, thank you. I mean, part of that. So let's start with the petty part of that. the petty part of that is that I want to be different and I'm iconoclastic and bombastic and all this kind of stuff that's just like, oh, I'm just a contrarian, all that kind of stuff. That's true and on one level. I mean, I get tired of things easily. I get tired of things when they change from being political into small talk. So that propels me forward in some way. But okay, that's just like the I'm an asshole thing. And that is, I like to deny that would not be entirely truthful. However, I try to view myself in a better light. And I do think that this is sort of more what it's about, which is I love resisting things. I love resisting power. I love resisting institutions and people in power. It's so important. And to me, that's a really enjoyable task. However, I always have my mind on formulating a positive politic. And by positive, I mean a sort of generative vision, a vision of the world that's generative to new ideas, to new problems, to new ways of life, that's not just about resisting what's here now. And that vision and wanting to engage with that is what gets me sort of past the resistance part. Mm-hmm. Because resistance is really, you know, it's really important and so valuable, and it's on the ground, has to happen now. And it helps so many people. But it doesn't ever, almost ever articulate a new kind of politics. So what you end up having is revolution, which, you know, that's the end of a lot of people's thinking is revolution. And it's like, well, you know, really that means to roll back, roll back. Mm-hmm. And so you end up just having the same old problems again with different people, you know, creating them. So I don't want a revolution. I want something beyond that. And that's what ends up propelling me, even though there's a resistance revolution component that's absolutely necessary.
It's really interesting that you're talking about this resistance and this vision, because I actually came across both of those elements when I was taking a look at your Twitter today and just kind of trying to put together some like really juicy topics that we could dig into. And so I'd love to start with this idea of resistance, because something that you were talking about recently on your Twitter is that there are lots of different schools of feminism that aren't anti-sex work, but most anti-sex worker oppression, at least in the West, is actually a result of anti-sex work feminists these days. Right. And I would love for us to kind of roll around in that a little bit. I think that there's still kind of this assumption that people who are anti-porn are like ultra religious kind of advocates. But in fact, what you're saying is that most of the anti-sex work voices that are out there right now are these like really vehement feminists.
Right. Well, so I've taken some shit publicly for saying these kinds of things because okay, because I'm a dude, and I, you know, it's like, I mean, to me, feminism is a sort of ideological, conceptual, philosophical justice framework. So it's not bound to one gender identity or expression. But of course, women are more capable of speaking about feminism than men. So I won't presume to be a feminism expert. Why I say some of the things I say comes from the fact that sex workers are oppressed by feminism. Now, before we go crazy, I know that it's not every type of feminism or every type of feminist. I don't homogenize feminism and say to attack all of it. I think we have to be honest that there is a continuity of feminisms and that they sort of flow in and out of each other, and that they're not just radical breaks, but actually they are related to each other in some way. And when you are part of a group that is marginalized by a conceptual, you know, in some senses ideological, theoretical framework, then you have a right to critique the framework, whether or not you are a woman, a man, some other, you know, whatever you would call yourself, gender expression-wise, gender identity-wise. I think that you have a right to critique it if it's, you know, one of the wellsprings of oppressing you. And real oppression, we're not talking about some, you know, rich white dude complaining about feminism. We're talking about sex workers who are actively persecuted actively hurt by feminist influences on culture, feminist influences on the law, feminist influences on power. And I'm not just talking about second wave feminism. There are versions and blends of feminism. I mean, I wouldn't call Lena Dunham a second wave feminist. And yet she's taken serious action against sex workers by publicly dismissing the Amnesty International research findings. So her, you know, you could say Anne Hathaway, who also signed that letter, whatever.
Yeah.
We can't lump them in with Andrea Dworkin. That's not fair. They do things that are much more, in some ways, progressive. And yet, sex workers are oppressed by the public statements that people like that make that end up funneling more power to the police, funneling more power to anti-sex bigotry, anti-sex lawmaker, anti-sex work lawmakers, all that kind of stuff. So sex workers have a right to critique feminism in the sense that even though lots of sex work is assisted, aided, you know, like helped out by feminist thought and feminist concepts, sex workers still in some dimensions stand outside of it. And are oppressed by it and have the right to critique it. So I think that that's a hard pill for people to swallow. Mm-hmm. And in some ways rightfully so. I mean, if feminism is made out to be the boogeyman all the time by the wrong people. However, this is really something that needs to be looked at and considered. And it can't just be like brushed away by saying, well, not the pure feminism, not the real feminism, not the great kinds of feminism, not all feminism. You know, any more than we should, not critique religions for their atrocity. But at the same time, I always also defend religions for the good things that they do as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think we need to lend that kind of equality. I just think that sex workers have a right to a different kind of critique of feminism than a lot of other people do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, because I think one of the things that stands out to me is that so often we have feminists who are speaking about sex work and sex workers without actually including the voices and experiences. And I love what you're saying about how we can be critical of feminism while also recognizing the good that it's doing and the progress that it's afforded us. And I think you really hit the nail on the head with feminism gets attacked so violently and vehemently from so many people like men's rights activists and stuff like that, that I think there's this knee-jerk reaction anytime someone sees something negative about feminism of just like, you can't say that.
Right.
But yeah, bringing this, including sex workers' voices, I think is a place where feminism has failed a great deal.
Yeah, I would mark it more. I mean, maybe the religion thing was actually sort of not the best analogy. I would put it more on the camp of criticizing Marxism and socialism, which for some people have really deep ties to their identity, although not gender, but identity. And would I afford the same amount of time listening to some conservative critique Marxism as I would someone who was in a gulag in the Soviet Union?
Right.
I would genuinely consider an important critique of someone who lived, you know, in a communist or in a Soviet state critiquing it. And again, I wouldn't totalize all of Marxism because of that. I don't think that that's necessary. I just think that once you become oppressed by a certain system of thought or a certain way of being, no matter who it is, if it's genuine oppression that's using power and violence, like state power and violence against you, then you have a right to critique regardless of your identity. I don't care if the person in the gulag is a nice person or has the best politics in the world or whatever.
Yeah.
I still find their critique of Marxism and communism valid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point when you talk about them being a good person or kind of having these like ideal characteristics that make them someone you want to listen to. I think that there's another tendency when we're talking about oppressed folks of like at any intersection, but especially around sex work, I think there's this tendency to only want to hear from voices in the sex industry who look a certain way, you know, are somewhat wholesome and somewhat like, oh, I could be friends with that person. And their stories have some type of like something that's palatable. I feel like that's one of the reasons why it's so rare to hear the voices of folks who do sex work that are actually like street economists or prostitution, because I think that people who are trying to elevate the voices of sex workers are scared that that's going to scare off the people who are even willing to listen to the more like palatable stories. So I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. And it's one that we struggle with. I mean, amongst sex workers, we struggle with that, right? Like you know, I don't want to speak for everybody. I mean, on my side, it's like, as a sex worker, I have a duty to listen to the people who were sex workers that didn't like it, or who felt coerced, or who felt whatever. And although I don't see those people as often, and I see some of those people as not genuine at all in their critiques or whatever, I still have a duty to listen to them. You know, and that's why I tell people, like, I'll argue for days with someone who was a sex worker that has a critique of sex work, if they're not just some crazy asshole, because there are those people too. But all that, you know, whether or not we should have mandatory condoms in porn, I'll argue that with a porn performer. You know, like, I'll debate that. I'll sit down and have that. When someone outside the community, like, you know, wanting to choose the person they want to be the face of, like, you know, to validate their own view from the outside, I'm not as interested in having debate, you know. It's like, so that's sort of, to speak to your point, although it's getting off the topic a little bit, I think there is definitely an idea of who is the right kind of victim of oppression all the time. And for me, I just try to keep as honest as possible, though I fail plenty of time, but I try to keep as honest as possible by just sort of thinking, okay, I'm listening to this person's argument. Is it valid or not? And of course their identity is a component of the argument, but it's not the end of the argument. And in fact, it's not really an argument in itself. It's just a component. Yeah. So.
Well, you brought up the condoms thing for porn performers, and I'd love to know if you'd be willing to share with our listeners just a little bit about Prop 60 that's going to be on the ballot in California.
Sure. So Prop 60, which everybody should know, has now been denounced by the California Democratic Party, is basically – I'm just going to do it in layman's terms.
Yes.
It's a proposition to instate Michael Weinstein of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation as the porn czar of California. This is one way to read it. So I add that to not be sued. one way of reading it, which I think is a great way, if you'd like to read it this way, because they're a very litigious group, is to instate Michael Weinstein as the porn czar of California to enforce mandatory condoms and certain testing protocols on the porn industry. And if you as a viewer of pornography see porn that's not satisfying those conditions, you can initiate legal action, which then will be taken over by whatever group is supposed to take it over, which will probably be, you know, in this scenario, run by Michael Weinstein, and reap some financial reward if the case against that porn company is proven. So pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's actually terrifying.
It's really bonkers. So people get the job to police pornography. It also puts them in direct relationship with the porn stars that they want to get in touch with for whatever reasons they might have.
Yeah. That point alone sounds terrifying, of just the potential of saying, I'll report you if you don't speak to me, or if you don't do this thing that I want, and like the blackmail potential and the stalking potential. And like, that's just terrible.
Yeah. And of course that anybody that's involved in the production, you know, their details are made public, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're in a lawsuit now.
Right.
So, you will have much more, people will have much more access to porn performers' names and addresses and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
And it's being billed by the folks who want this to pass as, we just want everyone in porn to be safe, and we know condoms protect people, so let's ensure all of our performers have condoms and this particular testing. And it's being kind of lauded, right, as this way to make porn even easier and healthier for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that's true that that's what it's saying. Mm-hmm. That's not true that that's what would happen.
What would happen. Right. Exactly.
Sure. I mean, it's, yeah.
Do you know when that's getting voted on?
That's November 8th.
Yeah. Okay. So it's this coming election.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to all of our listeners in California, please educate yourself about this particular ballot initiative, because it's getting a lot of press right now. I just saw that a judge ruled on an element of the proposition, and I know tons and tons and tons of porn performers have been very vocal on Twitter about wanting to make sure that this doesn't happen. And so I just wanted to make sure, since it's so in the news, that our listeners, specifically the ones in California, make sure that, they get educated about this.
And I will add on to that. If you hear porn performers or former porn performers saying they support it, there may be a few people that say that. That is not, as someone who works with hundreds of people in the adult industry, that is not representative of the industry. These are just sort of mm-hmm. people that don't know what they're talking about for the most part, or they might have a differing view, but they're by no means, not even the tiny portion of a representative. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, AIDS Healthcare Foundation, why do I say that? Because AIDS Healthcare Foundation has a few porn performers that it sort of carts out every time it tries to change the law. And they, you know, find some people here and there, and they're just not representative. And I say this as a porn performer who's used condoms in every single scene he's ever done. Yeah. So I'm not anti-condom, and I might have my own personal feelings about what kind of protection should be used and all that kind of stuff. This bill, it goes way beyond that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people have the right to have sex using whatever method of protection they would choose, you know,
right.
or frankly, not at all. If they and their partner are consenting mm-hmm. to none at all, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, it's just having autonomy over your own sexual experiences and your body. And the fact that someone wants to legislate the ways that people are allowed to engage in sex and what types of protection you have to use is just so upsetting to me, just for so many reasons. But yeah, to actually try and tell somebody this is the type of sex that you need to have, because we've made it illegal for you to have any other kind of sex, especially if it's, you know, in these specific circumstances, is just like really enraging.
Well, yeah. And I mean, there's this other little like aspect of it, which is really creepy and weird, which is, I mean, the reason porn is legal in the two places that it's definitely legal, and there may be some gray areas, but California and New Hampshire, is because it's considered art. So what they're saying is that they have the right to regulate art in some way. So already problematic.
Wow.
That they're regulating art, you know, with like, well, we're going to put these things in your artistic expression. But then there's another part to it, which is like, we're going to say this is art and violate that, but we're also going to say that this is not sex because that would be illegal and you shouldn't be having sex for money. So we justify this on the grounds that this is a labor safety issue or whatever. When it, in fact, I mean, plenty of people who make porn are making it because they want to have sex and there's a sexual component and there's an erotic component, you know? So I think we need to understand those aspects of it too. It's censorship, but it's also censorship that divides sex and art and sort of insidiously controls both at the same time.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I knew that porn was legal in California and New Hampshire, but I didn't realize it was because it was classified as art.
Well, freedom of expression, I should say. I mean, that's why prostitution is still sex work of that sort is still illegal, right? Mm-hmm. Because porn is covered under expression laws.
That makes a lot of sense because I know so many people have kind of made the joke of it's okay to have sex for money as long as a camera is present.
Right.
And so that makes a lot of sense that it would be this expression thing.
Which is not true in almost every state in this country, by the way.
Yeah.
So I mean, people make that joke, but it's not really true.
So just to kind of touch on that really quickly, for people who are making porn outside of California and New Hampshire, they're making themselves legally liable for
they're potentially, yes. Yeah. They're potentially, I mean, a lot of times these laws aren't enforced, mm-hmm. right? So they end up being like sodomy laws or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, but with the difference that there's physical evidence.
Right.
After you make a porn. So a lot of times these places are not, but you know, presumably someone could call the police on someone shooting a porn and have the entire crew and, you know, all the performers arrested.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, I would love to shift gears just a little bit and circle back to how at the beginning you were talking about the importance of resistance and then also how you really strive to have kind of this vision for what's next, to put a positive spin on it and to really, instead of focusing on the existing problems and kind of having this revolution where we're recreating the same problem, in fact, looking at new problems and new opportunities. And something else that you were recently talking about that caught my attention, and I'll admit, like, my little red flag went up of like, oh God, we're not ready for this conversation.
That's so good. I thought, so like, excited.
let's lean into the thing that scares me. So actually you did a couple of different things, but we're not going to have time for all of them. So, the first one is you were talking about making consent the foundation of sexual ethics frames everyone's default position as violating. And so you were saying, let's develop a better model and a better foundation. And I would love for you to kind of dig into that a little bit so that we can roll around in it.
Sure. Yeah. I don't have a better model yet. but that's because this conversation has not even really been opened by most people. I mean, the idea that communicating yes and no, and until we make those communications, we can't determine whether or not sex is consensual. That does mean that anything you do prior to that kind of communication is violating, is a sex offense. And I disagree with that. I mean, and part of why I disagree with that is because if you go to a gay bar, men grope each other, they grab each other's butts, they kiss each other on the cheek when they don't know each other. Now, I know that some gay people are listening to this, or maybe not, I don't know, but I know that some gay people that would hear me say that would be like, well, yeah, that's consent, and you violate someone's consent when you blah, 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 blah. And I can easily respond, that's homophobic. That is a complete break in the gay rights, the history of gay rights, the history of queer liberation. We have spaces where people don't ask to touch each other. Now, That's not the same as, you know, different sort of levels of sexual offense and sexual violation. But we are talking about spaces like that. We're, in the Middle East, you know, we touch each other. I mean, just knowing being Arab, we touch each other very sensually all the time. We caress each other. We put our arms around each other. We touch each other's thighs. We hug. We kiss on the lips. And those aren't even considered sexual acts. Mm-hmm. But in Western context, they are. So there's, first of all, this idea of consent that's already dominated by a certain kind of culture. And part of that comes out of trying to protect, once again, trying to protect women and their sexualities, because women need to be protected. Now, here we go again, because sure, women do need to be, do need to have safe spaces. Mm-hmm. And do need to feel, and part of that has to do with teaching people, men primarily, how to navigate sexual spaces in a way that's not just whatever the fuck you want, dude. Mm-hmm. You know. So I realize this is a very complicated issue, but can we find something that's better than assuming touch is violating? Assuming touch is not only violating, but irredeemably violating for someone who is touched without asking to be. Assuming that we are the violator until someone says yes. So I think there are all sorts of issues tucked in here that, you know, are really troubling to me. And a lot of it comes out of, you know, I talk about it as if it's a sentence, but it was painful reading College Code of Conduct, which, you know, related to Title IX, which has largely been a disaster for victims of sexual assault anyway. Mm-hmm. The sort of Title IX laws relating to, you know, basically juries of administrators on campus solving problems instead of, you know, the regular legal system, which is also a mess when it comes to sexual assault. But reading these and just thinking, nobody on this campus, first of all, you know, knows that they're having a menage a trois every time they have sex with their partner and the person who wrote the code of conduct, who's standing in the corner saying, nope, do it like this, do it like this, nope, do it like this, do it like this, do it like this. The university needs to be intervening in every little act. And as soon as you break the way that we define it, you're in violation as determined by us. There's a long history of that. The church used to do that in the 18th century. They would make allowances for people. Well, you can do whatever you want, but underneath what the church generally finds acceptable. So people felt some sort of sense of sexual freedom and safety, and yet could be persecuted by the church at any moment. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of problems with the way consent goes in culture. Black men for decades, were sent to prison for having sex with white women because white women couldn't possibly consent to having sex with black men. So rape was, and I think W.E.B. Du Bois said, you know, rape is like, everybody knows rape is like the new way to send black men to prison. Mm-hmm. Because whenever a white woman has sex with a black man, she can say that he raped her without too much question, because no white woman would be considered to consent. Rape laws, statutory rape laws, questions of consent used to imprison homosexuals. Mm-hmm. Usually if one man was older than the other, then the older man was, you know, at fault. So we have all these deeply troubling aspects of consent. And it doesn't just play out the way we want it to play out. And the thing I always say, I just encompass it under, we don't get to consent to the kind of consent we're allowed. And until... I mean, consent is usually defined by people and institutions in power. And we often are subjected to that form of consent for reasons that have nothing to do with our safety or our sexual freedom or our sexual gratification. So That's why I think it's a bad bedrock for a foundation of sexual ethics. Whether or not it gives us something good, I think of course it does. Of course. And of course, some of the sort of things that we've gotten out of having more discussions about consent, it's so important. Mm-hmm. And I just want to move forward and do better than that.
Yeah, that's what really strikes me as I listen to you is this, like, one of the things that came up for me as I was thinking, like, so many spaces, like, this just recently happened to me. I was at the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit last weekend in Alexandria, Virginia, which is awesome because they have tons of, like, sex worker panels and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, I was standing in the hotel and someone that was not with the conference came up to me and was very forward in a way that made me very uncomfortable and touched me, and I was not okay with being touched. And he was clearly doing kind of like the male gaze. If I compliment you right and touch you right, then you'll like want to take off all your clothes right now for me. And it just made me very uncomfortable. And thinking about what you're saying is like, when I think about places where I am and I don't mind the people around me are touching me, it's always in places where I feel safe and like there's fairly equal power distributed among like maybe all of my friends. You know, in certain circles with my friends, people can really touch me and hug me and I'm very open to it. And that feels good. But then in spaces where I feel like there is a power imbalance, maybe I'm in a space that has a lot of cis men, or I'm brand new at something and I'm around people that I really admire, then touch starts to feel like there's something else behind it. And I think it's just really interesting because like what you're talking about to me requires us really being able to heal like so many cultural wounds and like overcoming racism and sexism and like moving beyond all of these like oppressive systems to get to a place where then we can start exploring what this different version of like sexual exchanges looks like outside of the consent paradigm. And like part of me is like, wow, that would be so cool. And part of me is like, never gonna happen.
Well, you know, sure, we're a long ways away from it. I mean, there's a great, I'm going to get it wrong, but there's a great Wilhelm Reich quote where he says something like, you know, the only way to deal with sexual oppression is to deal with every form of oppression.
Yeah.
There's no way to deal with sexual oppression without dealing with all the other forms of oppression. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, he said that as a psychoanalyst because sexuality is, you know, at the core of everything, right? But that makes perfect sense to me in relation to what you're saying. We're not going to feel better about sex unless we work on all these other things as well. So we should see those as part of sex positivity. If we want to be sex positive, we have to have radical politics. And when you talk about this guy, right, I'm going to say something that I hope comes across as sort of warm and helpful and not not frustrating.
But oh, I think I know where you're going to go. So I welcome it.
Okay, good. So, you know, one of the problems with these sort of boundaries that we set for ourselves with consent is that in some ways, you know, we're doing dual work. And one is, okay, we're educating people to communicate. That's the great thing about consent, is that there's an educational process embedded in this cultural discussion about consent that makes us communicate better with each other, hopefully. The bad thing is when we concretize consent and make it, like I said, the bedrock, what we actually do in some ways is, you know, we end up creating more boundaries for ourselves. And what we actually end up doing is create more opportunities for violence. And what I, you know, and I think about that when you tell me this thing, you know, now, do I think that you were sort of like playing the victim in that? No, I felt that many times myself, someone just being a creep,
mm-hmm.
Someone touching me when I'm like, get your fucking hands off me, yep. All that. Now, of course, power differential, because I'm not a woman, but I felt feelings in my own way, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so without the threat, which is very important, but let me just talk about it from my own experience and then you can fill in the parts that I can't speak to.
Okay.
Okay. So you see how difficult these things are to talk about sometimes. So, but what I worry about is that when we start sort of creating more and more and more boundaries and tell ourselves that any crossing of a boundary means violation, we enhance and amplify the violence in boundary crossing. And at the same time, we're creating more boundaries. So we're creating more spaces for violence to occur. And that is sort of just like, you know, we keep contracting our world. And so my solution to that is always to say, have your boundaries, but investigate them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the best I can do right now. I'd like to think of something better to say than that, but boundaries are great. No one has the right ever to violate your boundary that you've set down. No one else has that right. However, you also have a responsibility and duty to investigate them. And if you don't do that work, then your boundary will either become a weapon or you'll continue to a weapon against others, or you'll continue to create more opportunities to experience violence. Mm-hmm. So it's dual work. And right now, culturally, we're really concerned with one side of that work, but not the other.
Yeah.
And I want us to be really concerned with both at the same time, because that's where the growth is going to start to happen, really, I think.
I think that we are, we're in a place right now where I feel like because we're starting to realize how little we know, and to date, I feel like a lot of the conversation that's been had on kind of the larger scale around consent, like with Title IX, has really lacked nuance. And we know all the things we're not supposed to do, but we haven't armed people with the tools to start actually finding a way to like live their experiences and navigate the gray areas. Mm-hmm. And to kind of grow from those, I've had several college students tell me like, I was drunk and these things happened and I don't feel like it was rape. I don't feel like it was assault, but like people are telling me that it is, and I'm not sure how to navigate that. And I feel like that's a huge place where we're failing too. It's like, we're so set on like checking the boxes of these things weren't okay, that we're not giving people permission to really like figure out if they're okay or not. It's, we're looking at the check boxes and telling people what their experiences are.
Right. It's really intense. I know two brothers who were both molested by their piano teacher when they were kids, and one has carried it with him and it's haunted him for his entire life. And the other is like, yeah, just felt kind of good. Mm-hmm. Now, it's crazy to see those two responses. Two brothers. So, I mean, same growing up circumstances too, right?
Yeah.
And same perpetrator. So two different responses. Mm-hmm. We need to allow for both responses to be possible, and we don't. And that is really problematic. Nobody has a right to tell anyone else what their sexual experience is. Mm-hmm. You just do not. Mm-hmm. And that's so hard for people to deal with. I mean, I have seen people say, you were raped to someone who did not feel raped in whatever situation. And the person's like, no, I wasn't. You know, in particular, I'm thinking of this 16-year-old girl who had sex with an adult man who's, you know, in his 20s. And she was like, no, I liked it. And I've seen a woman yelling at her and being like, you were raped. And she's like, no, I don't feel like that. And I'm like, well, that's, to me, that's SWRF attitude. Mm-hmm. I take away your autonomy to, and substitute it with my ideology.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and so, and I also want to add one other thing. You know, some of this perspective comes from growing up, you know, in Pennsylvania as a man who's attracted to men. Every sexual act I did felt uncomfortable for a long time because the culture around me told me that I was not supposed to have certain kinds of sex. And not only was it just the regular uncomfortable sex stuff that people go through because our culture is so shitty when it comes to sex. But there's also this whole other stigma, mm-hmm. you know, of being a broken human, of being, you know, a sinner. Although I wasn't raised religiously, I still have those questions of, you know, being abnormal, being, you know, a mutant and not in the fun superpower way. although then later discovering, yes, in the fun superpower way. but just, you know, I mean, think of that. It's like if we base everything on being able to say yes, then the people who have a difficult time saying yes because their sexual experiences are and sexual desires are completely stigmatized will always be afraid of violation. And when those first sexual experiences happen, in fact, probably feel violated and feel maybe irredeemably violated and lonely and isolated.
Yeah. I think that's such a powerful point and one that I'm going to probably like chew on all night long now. Well, I have like 10 other questions for you, but I also want to really respect the fact that you're having a super busy day and you popped on the show at the last minute, which I so appreciate. So I would love it if you would share with everybody who's listening where they can follow along with you and find you and stay in touch with you online.
Sure. I mean, the best way to find me is just on Twitter, which is at Connor Habib, and CONNERHABIB. And, you know, I mean, Dawn has said, so I say this to listeners, Dawn has said, you know, I say things that are challenging sometimes. Sometimes I'm a jerk. I often say that my tombstone will just read hashtag he was nicer in person. Because, I mean, for me, Twitter is, you know, Facebook has an algorithm that makes you only see the things that are pleasant. Mm-hmm. And I think the great thing about Twitter is actually that it doesn't let you do that. It's not always a nice place. And to me, that is really important. And so sometimes I come across as being, I'm not apologizing. I'm just saying, welcome to my Twitter if you come hang out. And I love that you're there. So please show up and hang out. but sometimes I will say things that, you know, make people feel uncomfortable and vice versa. People say things that make me feel uncomfortable all the time. Mm-hmm. I have a website, ConnorHabib.com, that just right now just basically links to my blog. So you can just sort of click through there. And I don't know. I mean, I give talks at universities and I do some online courses. So if you're interested in having me talk at your school or your organization or something, you can always reach out to me for that too. And then there'll be an appearance and you can keep in touch with me that way.
Yeah. And I'll just say to all of our listeners, I've had the pleasure of attending one of your online workshops and it was like really rich and such an enjoyable experience. And so for anyone who's interested in everything that you do, definitely keep an eye out for Connor's online courses because you won't be disappointed with the depth of the discussion that happens if you join that. So yeah, I just want to thank you so much for joining me, Connor. And I would love to have you back at some point to dig into a whole bunch of the other things that I want to like roll around with you in. So yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I always love talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So to all of our listeners, be sure to go to sexgetsreal.com. I will have all of Connor's links and bio and goodness from this episode. And thank you so much for listening. This is Dawn Sarah with Sex Gets Real.